Welcome to another deep dive. We are thrilled to have you, the learner, joining us today for an exploration of a sector that, well, it wields a staggering amount of influence over our daily lives, but it operates almost entirely in the background.
Yeah, it really does hide in plain sight.
Exactly. So to set the stage for this, I want you to consider a hypothetical. Imagine you have suddenly come into possession of billions of dollars.
And we aren't talking about a comfortable retirement fund here. We are talking about nation-state levels of wealth.
Right, huge money. And you've made the decision to give it all away to change the world. The immediate logistical question is, well, how do you deploy that capital? Do you build hospitals? Do you fund avant-garde art? Underwrite scientific research?
It's overwhelming to even think about.
It is. And perhaps the most difficult question of all is, say, 10 years down the line, without a quarterly earnings report or a stock price to look at, how would you or anyone else objectively know if your philanthropic endeavor actually succeeded?
Which is a profoundly difficult question.
Yeah.
I mean, it represents the central puzzle that philanthropic foundations grapple with constantly. We're looking at a space that controls immense concentrations of wealth, but structurally, it operates totally outside the traditional incentive structures of both the democratic government and the free market private sector.
Yeah.
So today, we're attempting to look past the surface level of charitable giving to really understand the sociological and historical why.
To navigate this, we are drawing on a highly revealing stack of research today. Our primary sources are a 2009 journal article called Measuring Social Values in Philanthropic Foundations, along with some really detailed excerpts from a 2006 doctoral thesis. And both of these texts were authored by researcher John R. Whitman.
And our mission here is to unpack the hidden logic of philanthropic foundations. We're going to examine how they determine their capital allocation, how researchers are actually attempting to empirically measure whether these organizations are living up to their own stated ideals.
Which is harder than it sounds.
Much harder. And we'll also look at how historical shifts, some dating back centuries, still dictate whether a modern foundation chooses to fund a public policy think tank, a local library, or a homeless shelter today.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because Whitman's research is particularly compelling,
Yeah. He
essentially takes on the challenge of quantifying something that is notoriously ethereal.
Right. He's trying to pin down the underlying invisible values that drive philanthropic giving and then map how those values shift across different global cultures.
But before we get to the cultural differences, we have to address the fundamental measurement problem you alluded to. Evaluating the efficacy of a foundation is just an absolute logistical headache.
Oh, it's a nightmare. If you're an analyst evaluating a for-profit enterprise, your metrics are standardized. You look at EBITDA, profit margins, year-over-year revenue growth. It's highly objective, but the sources highlight that foundations operate in a completely different reality. They often lack clearly defined, actionable purposes. Their mission statements tend to rely on incredibly broad platitudes about, you know, improving the human condition or fostering global prosperity.
How do you construct a spreadsheet to measure something that vague?
You really can't. The traditional approach in the nonprofit sector has been to just bypass the broad mission statement and simply evaluate the specific localized programs they fund. You measure the instrumental outcome.
Right. Like, did a specific grant result in a measurable decrease in malaria infections in a given region?
Exactly. Or did it result in the construction of 50 affordable housing units? But the research introduces a crucial counter perspective from historian Peter Dobkin Hall, which really complicates this traditional method.
Hall's distinction here is fascinating. He points out that the public, and even a lot of analysts, mistakenly assume that all foundations operate on an instrumental basis.
Instrumental meaning the capital is deployed specifically to achieve a highly measurable, objective, and usually utilitarian result.
Right. But Hall notes that a massive portion of the philanthropic sector is actually what he terms expressive.
And understanding that distinction is absolutely vital. An expressive foundation deploys its capital not to solve a systemic crisis, but simply to propagate a value.
Consider a foundation whose sole mandate is to support classical music or preserve local art museums.
Yeah, they aren't attempting to eradicate poverty or cure a disease. The financial gift itself is the expression of the organization's purpose.
So if an auditor attempts to evaluate an expressive foundation using instrumental metrics, asking how many lives were saved by funding a local symphony, they're going to get a false negative on the foundation's efficacy.
They're entirely missing the point of why the institution exists in the first place.
Which is the exact analytical gap that Whitman's framework attempts to close. Recognizing that program-level metrics fail to capture the broader purpose of expressive organizations, he proposed that we should evaluate foundations based on their underlying social values.
To execute this, he actually developed a measurement instrument featuring 33 highly specific social values.
The list includes concepts like community, education, efficiency, pluralism, sustainability, and equity.
And we should definitely pause here to carefully define what the texts mean by social values in this context. It's so easy to conflate these with personal ethics or corporate culture.
Yeah, they are not referring to an individual's personal sense of honesty.
No, nor are they referring to an organizational priority like maintaining corporate transparency or having a healthy work-life balance for employees.
They are operating on a macro level. These social values are defined as normative beliefs about a preferred society.
Exactly. When a foundation institutionalizes a social value like pluralism or sustainability, they are projecting a literal vision for a better world.
They're signaling to the public, this is the structural blueprint of the society we believe should exist, and we are going to leverage our endowment to actively engineer it.
Taking that framework, Whitman designed a rather ingenious alignment test. He essentially wanted to see if the capital allocation matched the institutional rhetoric.
Putting their money where their mouth is.
Precisely. He surveyed foundation CEOs across the United States, Canada, and Europe, asking them to rank their espoused values on a scale. He established what these leaders claimed their organizations cared about the most.
And then came the empirical reality check. He requested their actual 2005 grant records to construct what he called an ex post facto budget.
The ex post facto budget is such a brilliant methodology. Instead of looking at forward-looking strategic plans, which are often highly aspirational, he looked backward at the actual cleared checks.
He mapped every dollar spent in 2005 against his 33 social values to see if the reality of their grant-making matched the values they had just claimed were their highest priorities.
And the data revealed a significant gap between rhetoric and reality. The consistency between stated values and actual funding was far from perfect.
Whitman detailed three specific case studies to illustrate this, right?
He did. A mid-sized foundation based in Europe demonstrated a 65% consistency rate. A large foundation in the United States hit an 86% consistency rate. And a small foundation in Canada achieved a 91% alignment.
It's like saying you deeply value eating healthy, but then you look at your credit card statement and see a bunch of fast food charges.
That's a great way to put it. It's a dynamic you see in the corporate world quite often, particularly with ESG, environmental, social, and governance commitments.
Right. A major firm might publish a massive annual report claiming environmental sustainability is their core value, but their actual capital expenditure shows heavy investment in legacy fossil fuels.
There is a frequent disconnect between the PR of the stated value and the reality of the capital deployment. Though, looking at Whitman's interviews with these CEOs, they provided some very practical, real-world reasons for the mismatch.
Yeah, the misalignment wasn't necessarily born of institutional hypocrisy. The CEOs pointed out the realities of the grant cycle. Sometimes an organization is forced to respond to unexpected exogenous shocks.
Like a sudden natural disaster or a geopolitical crisis.
Exactly. That requires them to deploy capital in ways that don't neatly align with their strategic long-term priorities.
They also noted the issue of deal flow. A foundation is generally reactive. They rely on receiving grant proposals from nonprofits and NGOs.
Right. If a foundation decides environmental sustainability is their top value for the year, but they simply don't receive high-quality, viable proposals from environmental organizations, they cannot effectively deploy capital in that sector.
The money has to go to the best available proposals, even if they fall under secondary values.
The alignment test is revealing, but Whitman's research yielded another, perhaps more profound, set of data. By applying this 33-value framework internationally, he was able to map how preferred social values differ across geographical and cultural lines.
Comparing the U.S., Canada, and Europe really reveals the underlying sociological DNA of these distinct regions.
It is worth establishing the baseline first, though. Because despite the regional differences, there was a universal consensus on certain foundational pillars.
Across all three regions surveyed, the foundations completely agreed on the high importance of five specific values.
Community, education, equity, innovation, and knowledge. Those seem to represent the shared bedrock of Western philanthropic thought.
The divergence from that bedrock is what warrants closer analysis. When you look at the unique values prioritized by each region, distinct civic personalities emerge.
And this is where it gets really interesting. the data showed that the United States had a unique, highly pronounced focus on the value of independence.
While Canada uniquely prioritized equality, health, and voice.
And Europe stood out for a heavy emphasis on human rights, solidarity, and sustainability.
When you lay those priorities out side by side, the American emphasis on independence versus the European emphasis on solidarity, it forces a broader historical question. Why do these distinct regions conceptualize the ideal society so differently?
The source material suggests that to understand modern capital allocation, you really have to examine the deep historical and theological roots of charity itself.
To trace that lineage, the research takes us back to the ancient world, looking at structures like the Code of Hammurabi around 2250 BC. In early civilizations, there was no separation between civic administration and religious authority.
Ancient rulers claimed divine right to justify their absolute authority over the populace.
However, this absolute power was predicated on a social contract. In exchange for the divine right to rule, the monarch carried a strict moral and religious obligation to provide welfare.
The ruler was positioned as a benevolent paternal figure obligated to provide for the vulnerable. The state and the religious institution were functionally the exact same welfare entity.
That monopoly on social welfare held for millennia, particularly through the dominance of the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages.
But the texts pinpoint a massive historical fracture that fundamentally rewired Western society's approach to charity, the Protestant Reformation in the early 16th century.
This theological schism permanently altered the socioeconomic landscape. It was a paradigm shift in how individuals related to authority and community.
The prevailing Catholic tradition had always emphasized a communitarian approach to society. It supported a paternalistic state structure and placed a high religious value on direct charity to address immediate physical needs.
The moral imperative of feeding the hungry and clothing the poor as an act of grace.
Right. But the Protestant tradition, driven by figures like Martin Luther and later John Calvin, dismantled that framework.
It emphasized a direct, unmediated personal relationship with God, actively bypassing the institutional authority of the church.
And what starts as a theological debate regarding individual salvation inevitably bleeds into secular social policy.
Because the emphasis on the individual's direct relationship with God fosters a culture of intense individual responsibility. It breeds a preference for a decentralized, weaker state apparatus.
And it lays the philosophical groundwork for what sociologist Max Weber famously termed the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism.
The texts actually rely on the framework established by researcher Lute Tyart de Bormes to demonstrate how this historical fracture resulted in the varied modern models of civil society we see across Europe today.
Tyart de Bormes outlines four distinct models, right?
Yes. First is the Anglo-Saxon model, primarily seen in the UK. This model leans heavily on 19th century Protestant liberalism, resulting in a society that prefers a weaker central state and relies heavily on a robust independent civil society and high levels of individual volunteerism to address social needs.
Contrast that with his second category, the Rhine model, which covers nations like Germany and Belgium. Here you see a corporatist approach.
The state is highly involved, but rather than providing services directly, it legally contracts civil society organizations to address social needs.
Interestingly, these organizations are often heavily siloed along ideological or religious lines, acting almost as proxies for the state's welfare budget.
Then there is the Latin or Mediterranean model, visible in countries like France and Italy. This model is deeply rooted in the historical Catholic tradition. Citizens in these nations have strong, ingrained expectations that the state itself is the paternal provider of social services.
Because the public views welfare as the state's strict duty, there's often significant cultural resistance to private foundations stepping in to privatize those services.
Finally, there's the Scandinavian model, which is a unique hybrid. It combines a very strong, heavily taxed central state with a Protestant ethic of civic initiative.
In this model, private foundations often act as experimental incubators. They identify and fund new social needs, and once a program is proven successful, the state steps in to absorb it into the public welfare system.
Understanding those European models provides the perfect context for analyzing Canada. The texts describe Canada as representing a third way, which makes perfect sense when you look at its demographic history.
Canada is the product of a unique historical collision. You have the French Catholic tradition, which brought an expectation of a strong, central, paternalistic state, merging with British Protestant history, which brought the values of individual responsibility and civic volunteerism.
The synthesis of those two distinct historical forces produced a syncretic, selectively socialist welfare state. In the Canadian model, the government is broadly accepted by the public as the primary legitimate driver of social value.
The state efficiently handles massive universal social programs, most notably universal health insurance and national pensions.
Therefore, the Canadian Philanthropic Foundation operates in a collaborative supplementary role, working alongside a government that is already deeply structurally involved in the welfare of its citizens.
But if we look at the United States, the trajectory of that Protestant Anglo-Saxon influence resulted in an entirely different philanthropic ecosystem.
In the late 19th century, the American Industrial Revolution generated titans of industry who amassed concentrations of private wealth that really had no historical precedent.
This era gave rise to Andrew Carnegie, who in 1889 published his highly influential treatise, The Gospel of Wealth. This document essentially serves as the foundational charter for the modern American Philanthropic Foundation.
Carnegie's philosophy represented a radical departure from the traditional Catholic model of direct alms. His approach was deeply steeped in Protestant individualism and the harsh realities of early capitalist expansion, really bordering on social Darwinism.
He explicitly argued that giving direct financial handouts to the poor was structurally dangerous to the progress of society.
He firmly believed it incentivized dependence and rewarded unproductive behaviors.
His writings were remarkably blunt on this point. He argued that the surplus wealth of the industrialized few should not be redistributed as a safety net, but should instead be aggressively administered by the wealthy to build ladders for the ambitious to climb.
His vision of social engineering involved building permanent infrastructure, universities, public libraries, meeting halls.
The crucial caveat in his philanthropy, looking objectively at the data provided in the text, researchers observed a distinct strategic divergence between ideological camps in how they utilized the foundation structure.
Rich's analysis indicates that starting in the 1970s, conservative foundations adopted a highly cohesive overt strategy. They effectively utilized their endowments to fund policy institutes and think tanks organizations like the Heritage Foundation in the U.S. and the Institute of Economic Affairs in the U.K.
The explicit stated goal of this capital deployment, according to the source material, was to shift broader political and social norms toward values centered around free market economics and limited government intervention.
The texts note that this strategic funding of think tanks was remarkably successful in shifting the Overton window of the political conversation during that era.
Conversely, Rich's research found that during the same time period, liberal foundations operated with a different methodology. The data suggests they often avoided explicitly stating their ideological commitments, preferring to disassociate themselves from overt political labels.
The researchers suggest that this reluctance to explicitly align with a cohesive political ideology may have made their efforts to shift macro-level social norms less cohesive and ultimately less effective when compared to the highly targeted strategies of their conservative counterparts.
It is a striking example of how the legal structure of the foundation can be weaponized, in the most academic sense of the word, to engineer a specific vision of society.
But this outsized influence on national political discourse leads to a fascinating contradiction regarding their actual financial weight.
Right. When we discuss foundations funding major think tanks, universities, and global health initiatives, it creates the perception that these organizations possess near infinite resources.
The source material provides a snapshot from 2003, noting that U.S. foundations collectively gave away $30.3 billion that year.
$30 billion sounds like a monumental, market-moving amount of capital. But the texts provide a macroeconomic reality check that completely recontextualizes that figure.
That $30.3 billion distributed by the entire U.S. philanthropic sector in 2003 was actually less than the combined annual profits of just two major corporations that year, General Electric and Citigroup.
The comparison becomes even more stark when you look at top-line revenue. That $30.3 billion was merely a fraction of Walmart's $246.5 billion in revenue for the exact same year.
And when you compare the philanthropic sector to the public sector, the scale is humbling. The total giving of all U.S. foundations amounted to roughly 1.4% of the U.S. federal budget.
This is the central paradox of the sector. If the collective financial power of every foundation in the U.S. is essentially a rounding error compared to the federal budget or the revenue of a single retail conglomerate, why do philanthropic foundations matter?
How do they exert such disproportionate influence over public policy, global health, and social norms?
The answer lies in the unique nature of their capital. Their power is not derived from sheer volume. It is derived from leverage.
Democratic governments are fundamentally encumbered by the immediate pressures of the next election cycle and the heavy responsibility of stewarding taxpayer dollars. They are naturally risk-averse.
Publicly traded corporations are equally encumbered by the fiduciary duty to generate quarterly profits for their shareholders. Foundations exist in a rare vacuum, unburdened by either of those constraints.
Because their capital is tied up in independent, tax-exempt endowments, they have unparalleled operational agility. A foundation doesn't have to worry about polling data or a dip in their stock price.
They can afford to take massive long-term risks. They can convene world-class experts, set aggressive global agendas, and fund radical experimental theories of change that no government agency could ever legally or politically justify risking taxpayer money on.
They are the ultimate catalyst capital. They lack the resources to fund the entire social safety net, but they possess the exact type of capital required to fund the spark that permanently alters the system.
They are acting as independent social engineers, leveraging their agility to target the root causes of systemic issues rather than just treating the symptoms.
Their financial footprint might be comparatively small, but their strategic footprint is vast.
Which brings this entirely back to you, the learner. The built environment and the civic infrastructure around you are not neutral. The next time you walk past a privately funded community center, or you read an op-ed based on a new public policy paper, or you hear about a massive initiative overhauling a local school district, look a little closer.
You are not just looking at brick and mortar or a simple academic document. You are looking at a materialized social value.
You are witnessing a highly specific normative vision of a better world, funded by an organization acting as a social engineer and heavily dictated by centuries of theological and cultural history.
Recognizing that infrastructure changes how you navigate the civic space. And I want to leave you with one final structural implication to consider. We noted earlier that these foundations operate through tax-exempt endowments.
That is a critical mechanism to remember.
The capital they are deploying is surplus wealth that, absent this legal structure, would have otherwise been collected as tax revenue and deposited into the public treasury. It leads to a profoundly difficult philosophical question regarding the modern social contract.
It really does.
If foundations operate using untaxed surplus wealth capital that theoretically could have been deployed as public funds, who truly owns the social values being engineered? Should a democratic public have a formalized voice in shaping the visions that these private entities enforce on society? Or is the deployment of this capital the absolute rightful prerogative of the individuals who generated the wealth in the first place?
That is the ultimate tension between private capital and the public good, and it is a heavy concept to chew on. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope this exploration gave you a new analytical lens for viewing the civic infrastructure around you. Keep questioning the systems operating in the background, and we will catch you next time.